So without further ado, I'll just introduce Duncan. So Duncan Hart's a member of the Brisbane branch, and he's been a member for a while now. You said 10th Marxism Conference?
10th Marxism.
Yeah. And he's a student activist as well. The way the session will work is Duncan will speak for about 30 minutes. People should make notes of points they want to draw out, any questions they have, and there'll be plenty of time for discussion afterwards. Cool. Well, welcome, Duncan.
Thanks, Claire. All right. Well, so this is a bit of a little explored topic, so hopefully it'll be educational, but also it's going to be about drawing out some of the, you know, themes around the Gulag system in general, which might be a bit more controversial, as well as the specifics of this particular uprising. So the Vorkuta uprising is a heroic example of the importance of political organisation and resistance in even the direst circumstances, which we continue to see echoes of today with the resistance of the refugees on Manus Island and Nauru in Australia's own gulags. So prisoners in one of Stalin's Arctic gulags struck as part of a wave of resistance across the forced labour camps between 1952 and 1954 that actually helped end the era of mass repression in the USSR. And this is something I think most people would not be familiar with. Most of the prisoners in Vorkuta were political activists, so I'm going to actually use their words to recount the strike. But before I can get to, you know, actually just sort of going through that narrative, I think it's important that we try to understand the structure and the role of Gulag, which is a acronym for the Russian acronym for Main Camps Administration, in the Stalinist economic and social system. So Gulag was a system of forced labour established in 1930. It marked the end of a system of prisons instituted by the Bolsheviks that focused on the idea of rehabilitation of offenders. Instead, the Gulag was founded to repress opposition to Stalin's industrialization drive and grew to assume an important economic function within the Soviet society. Prisoners were swept up into Gulag in three key waves that reflected shifts in the political needs of the Stalinist regime. Firstly, during the first five-year plan that began in 1928. This was the first major push to industrialize Russia and involved, and the most horrific part of it, the collectivization of the peasantry. The Gulag population reached 2 million as peasants were arrested, and that's an increase on 200,000 before Gulag was implemented, and their land and their livestock seized. Secondly, the second wave was during the Great Terror of 1936 to 1938, when the old Bolsheviks and the party opposition were exterminated. At that time, the population of the camps peaked at 2.5 million. During the war, the Gulag population declined, but surged again to 2.5 million as Stalin's new empire consolidated itself in Eastern Europe. So to get a sense of what Vorkuta is like, I've got some photos. So it's part of the area of the Siberian tundra. It's above the Arctic Circle. This is what it looks like in summer. So it's just basically totally flat, featureless landscape with, when the snow melts, lots of water. And this is what it looks like most of the time. And that's near the Ural Mountains, which is why there's actually anything there. But otherwise, it's mostly just very flat, bleak landscape. The sun does not set during the peak of summer, nor rise during winter. From October to April, the average maximum temperature, is 0 degrees Celsius. From December to February, the maximum temperature is negative 20 degrees. Vorkuta, why was it even a place? It was prospected for coal in 1931, and then it became part of Gulag in 1933. Forced labour was needed by the Stalinist regime to exploit from Vorkuta crucial resources necessary for industrialisation because the region was too remote and inhospitable to be attractive to free labourers. The Ministry of Internal Affairs, the NKVD, concentrated Trotskyist oppositionists in Vorkuta from 1936, and the vast majority of those opposition were murdered 2 years later. By the time of the strike in 1953, half of coal and 80% of timber production in the USSR was produced through forced labour. So Vorkuta was a crucial part in that system. Vorkuta received first prize for coal production in the USSR in 1950. It had become, by that time, actually a major city. starting off as, you know, the extermination hub for the opposition, but by 1950 had grown to a population of 100,000, mostly ex-prisoners, who were exiled to that city or found it impossible to escape from economic reasons, and about 50,000 people who were prisoners living in 13 camps that surrounded the city. After their release, as I said, prisoners were typically given a term of exile, often in a remote location they were sent to in chains. So Vorkuta was an example, but this happened all across the gulags. So in terms of getting information about the situation for what it was like in the gulags, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, which is based on interviews with hundreds of detainees, is a seminal and harrowing source for understanding that system. You know, there's definitely points to criticise about Solzhenitsyn. He drew right-wing conclusions, anti-revolutionary conclusions out of his situation. But in terms of an example of the sort of situation of Gulag, his is probably still the best account. He was not imprisoned in Vorkuta. He was actually imprisoned in Kazakhstan, but it still traces a typical outline of what you know, the course of someone's arrest and their imprisonment was like in the Gulag system. So I'm going to start with I'm going to try and take a similar course. So what was like? How did you actually get into Gulag? And these accounts are based on accounts of people who lived through this time, and you know, they found it, they were very inspired by their experience, the resistance that they were a part of, and they actually you know, there was many accounts published either overseas or in underground press in the USSR. So most often, someone who had caught the attention of the NKVD would be taken in the dead of night from their homes, so midnight or 2 a.m. They would be bundled into a prison van, colloquially known as a Black Maria. And these were grey-painted vans, but after the war, they were decorated with bright paints or like fake advertising slogans to obscure the actual purposes. So a famous one was, you know, drink Soviet champagne. And the Black Maria would transport arrested people to their local NKVD headquarters. The most infamous of these headquarters in these prisons was the Lubyanka building in Moscow, which is today the headquarters of the Russian Federal Security Bureau. And that sort of shows you how, you know, these things haven't changed that much. Sometimes people would be locked up in Lubyanka for years, usually if they were considered to be important to the state or being kept for interrogation. So people like Zinoviev, Bukharin, Kamenev, and many other oppositionists were locked up in the Lubyanka for many years. So this is what the Lubyanka looks like. It's a very stately and awesome-looking building in the middle of Moscow, but underneath that building hides many cells, which we'll get to. So those arrested were forced to sign a confession of their crime, and this is a typical way that they were conducted, and they were sentenced without a trial, usually to either a 10 or 25-year term in a so-called corrective labour camp, which was then followed by internal exile. The NKVD extracted confessions through psychological and physical torture. The cells of the Lubyanka were brightly lit by electric bulbs, even during the night, when interrogations usually occurred. Prisoners the jailers sought to break were deprived of sleep, obviously. At different times, the Stalinist regime prescribed the NKVD an arrest quota. So they'd literally just send the local bureau of the NKVD, you have to arrest 30,000 people in your area. Many prisoners had been detained arbitrarily to meet these quotas, or because they had committed a small infraction at work, or had gotten on the wrong side of a figure in authority. To invent charges, the interrogator would try to get the detainee to implicate themselves in wrongdoing. So they'd ask questions about, you know, what have you done, where have you gone, who do you know? And if they said something that might be in any way imply that they might have done anything wrong, charge them with a, you know, counter-revolutionary terrorism. And this is how they were able to extract confessions. And they would tell prisoners that their relatives were imprisoned, that the screams they could hear in the distance were loved ones, or that they would, you know, by admitting to some charges, that they would be treated leniently. So this is just to give you a sense of what it would have been like if you were there. This is these are the interrogation cells underneath the Lubyanka. So you can see that there's these steel doors, and these things here are the peepholes. The jailers would walk along the cells, and you'd only have a few seconds of privacy where they wouldn't be watching you at all times. And this is the inside of one of the cells. So it's very bleak. So To get onto like some of the people's actual experiences of this situation, Dr. Joseph Schulmer was a communist arrested in 1949 in East Germany and accused of being an agent of the Gestapo and of US and British intelligence. During his interrogation, he was faced with those, you know, pretty serious charges, and his interrogator convinced him, in order to avoid execution, that he should admit to these charges, which he did, and he was sent to Vorkuta, where he participated in the 1953 strike. And there are others that received much harsher treatment than just being hoodwinked into agreeing to being sent to the Gulag. During the Great Terror in particular, physical torture was routinely practiced in order to elicit confessions and to implicate further targets for the NKVD. To give one example, an old Bolshevik from Petrograd, Abram Altman, was arrested in 1938 and accused of ties to Trotskyists. When the NKVD interrogators demanded names, Altman refused. The NKVD crushed his fingers in the hinges of a door, bashed him over the head, and forced him to stand without sleep for 3 days in a cell with water up to his knees. But still, he didn't give any names. Eventually, the NKVD whipped his genitals with a cane, but still he would not break. And the ordeal rendered him blind, but that did not stop the NKVD sentencing him to 10 years of forced labour. So in the camps, inmates, and they were called Zeks, which is another abbreviation of a Russian word for prisoner, were forced to perform grueling labour with meagre tools, felling timber, mining gold or coal obviously being what was mined at Vorkuta, or building infrastructure. At Vorkuta, they were able to at least have picks and shovels. Labourers were forced to meet a quota of production in order to qualify for rations above a starvation level. So if you didn't reach your quota, then you wouldn't get enough to eat. And if you failed, you would receive those lower rations, making it even harder to continue to produce, make it hard to continue to survive. Guards addressed prisoners by the numbers they were forced to wear on their uniforms. And isn't that eerily similar to the boat number the Australian government prescribes refugees today in Australia? So this is what an example of the prison uniform was. That's actually Solzhenitsyn, but that's what it was for everybody. A number on the front, number on the cap, and a number on the back as well, which you can't see. So yeah, and the prisoners lived in very crowded barracks as well. And this is an example. So that's like the bunks that they would have lived in Vorkuta. People sleeping in that photo. This is a propaganda photo, but it sort of shows you how many people are actually crowded into the bunks. It's been done up and they're wearing uniforms that are much nicer than they would actually have been wearing. With no numbers as well. And that's the obviously the perimeter fence and the watchtower. These are actually from Vorkuta. So within the camps, non-political prisoners were given privileges and treated with greater leniency compared to those charged under political offences. And this was a transparent attempt to divide the prisoner population and further oppress the lowest rung of the camp hierarchy. Non-political prisoners would often cruelly mistreat the political prisoners, primarily robbing them, and they're also able to do so without retribution because they occupied positions in the camp hierarchy as snitches, foremen, wardens, and so on. The Stalinist state justified this state of affairs by saying that common criminals were a social ally of the proletariat, unlike those enemies of the Soviet state convicted for political crimes, which of course were, you know, members of the bourgeoisie. That's just bullshit, by the way. They were actually oppositionists or peasants or other workers. And to give an example of another person who was swept up into this, Alla Tumanova was a 17-year-old woman arrested in 1951 during her final year at school for organising a reading group of classic Marxist and Bolshevik texts that began to draw critical conclusions about the regime. Two of her friends were executed and she was sent to Vorkuta. And so she described her job in the mine like this. And there actually is a photo, I think, of the mine. Our brigade worked at a coal mine face. We had to lug waste heaps from place to place, shifting the smoking rock with shovels. The work was unbearable, and not only because we were suffocating and made ill by the clouds of reddish smoke. For 5 minutes, our faces covered up to the eyes, we were tossed shovelful after shovelful, almost without breathing. Then we would race away, several metres away, tear rags off our faces, convulsively swallow air, and then return to the scorching heat. So Schulmer described those same quotas as being the norm was fixed so high that everyone had to work as hard as he could if the brigade was to be finished before the early shift came on. If I didn't do my work, then someone else had to do it for me. And they couldn't do that because they had more than enough already. Malnutrition in the system was rife, weakening the Zex muscles too much to function normally, leading many to develop abdominal hernias from the work. Most prisoners, however, delayed treatment of the hernias until winter, remembering that's like negative 20 degrees, to try to get time off work in those sort of very dangerous conditions. Scholmer, who had been a doctor in East Germany before his arrest, described how he used his medical skills to delay the recovery of my patients. I had many cases in which the prisoners were being made to do such very heavy work that their only chance of survival lay in getting me to make them ill. I had the opportunity of learning a whole host of methods which the prisoners used to induce or fake illness. They inject themselves under the skin with petrol. This leads to a chronic festering which stubbornly defies every form of treatment. A sore on the lower part of the leg is produced easily enough by breaking the skin and rubbing in dirt. I took over all these methods myself and perfected them. Yeah, if you inject yourself with petrol, definitely don't do that. The mortality rate in the gulags prior to 1948, and there was sort of a significant improvement in the situation after that, but prior to 1948 was around 4% a year, which, you know, oh, 4% doesn't sound too bad. Well, that was 80,000 people every year dying of unnatural causes. And during the Great Terror and the war years, when many camps received no rations whatsoever, around 9% of the people in the camps died in any year. So, after 1948, by 1953, a number of changes had begun to occur across the entire camp system that precipitated the struggles of 1952 to 54. The camp population grew after the war, and its composition changed. And the people that were going into the camps this time were quite different from what had happened, the composition before. Hundreds of thousands of Soviet soldiers who had become prisoners of war under the Nazis were transferred straight from their Nazi captors to Gulag, as they had disobeyed Stalin's order outlawing surrender. With the annexation and occupation by the USSR of Eastern Europe, huge numbers of nationalists and others who opposed Russian domination were arrested and interned. The largest numbers came from Western Ukraine, where the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists fought a desperate war for independence against the NKVD right into the 50s, followed by Poles and then people from the Baltic states that were also annexed by the USSR, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. So Volkhuda and the Gulag system generally was actually a veritable melting pot of every group oppressed by the Soviet Empire. There was actually a joke amongst the prisoners, which is still said by the residents of Volkhuda today, that Volkhuda is the capital of the world because it has so many different nationalities that were imprisoned by the Russians, locked up in that camp. So while the camps had always been filled with people charged for political offences, there was a new quality to this composition. There were neither peasants with little political experience that had flowed into the camps during collectivization, and nor were they living in the period of the Great Terror, where people were likely to be, you know, executed. By 1953, the camps were inhabited by this mix of soldiers, oppressed nationalities, political oppositionists of a broad spectrum, including many religious sects, who were easily singled out by the NKVD. So the soldiers were often conservative in their ideas about the Stalinist system, but they were used to violence. And large numbers of people from similar ethnic backgrounds with existing anti-Soviet political histories were interned together, and that helped to foster collective identity. For example, a key figure in the 1953 strike, Edward Bucha, had previously been a member of the anti-Nazi resistance movement in Poland, the Polish Home Army. If people don't know, that's a very famous incident with the Polish Home Army during World War II. In 1944, Soviet troops, following direct orders from Stalin, allowed German forces to defeat a huge uprising that the Polish Home Army had organised in Warsaw. And, that was brutally put down by the Nazis. So, rather understandably, Polish nationalists were extremely hostile to the new Soviet occupiers. Bucha was arrested in May 1945, so after the defeat of the Nazis, once the Soviets were establishing their occupation, after attempting to assassinate a communist official, and he was sent to Volkhuda for 20 years hard labour. So altogether, this situation. There was an improvement in the conditions. There wasn't starvation as there had been during the period of the war. There wasn't the shadow of actual, you know, being executed unnecessarily straight away. These were conditions ripe for resistance. The earliest example of coordinated rebellion from this period was a spectacular breakout attempt in the Vorkuta camps, and it happened in either 1947 or 1948. Obviously, all these things are being suppressed. It's hard to tell exactly. It was led by a Russian soldier called Colonel Boris McTeeve. Coordinating with other ex-officers of the Red Army, McTeeve and 5,000 of his fellow prisoners was able to take over four camps in Vorkuta, seize weapons from the guards, and they planned to march across the tundra to the city of Vorkuta itself. The insurgents hoped that having launched such a large-scale uprising, the Western powers would be pressured to intervene and to overthrow Stalin's regime. In the end, McTeeve's heroic rebels were defeated in a pitched battle as they marched on the city, as the NKVD brought to bear aircraft and, gunned down the prisoners. The battle actually lasted several days, but unfortunately the prisoners were massacred. Now, this heroic but doomed strategy reflected a changing mood of rebellion in the camps. In Vorkuta and elsewhere, underground committees existed in every camp, usually based around national minorities or the political tendency that the prisoner hailed from. Despite the repression, these political organizations proliferated, and in fact, there's some evidence that at Vorkuta, unified political themes emerged across the underground. Edward Bucher's committee consciously ensured representation from every national group. Amongst many of the Russian prisoners, students who held to a form of Marxism that criticised the Stalinist state, like Alla Tumanova, were politically influential, with a fully-fledged program of workers' control, ending totalitarianism, and national liberation for the oppressed minorities. This is remarkable given the history of nationalist rivalries and persecutions among each group. You know, many of these groups had, even the organisations they hailed from, had been involved in massacres of different national minorities, you know, in World War II in particular. And it really shows the potential for workers to unite based on a common project of liberation. As the underground committees solidified, they began to embolden the prisoners to defy their most immediate oppressors, which are those prisoners who collaborated with the authorities in return for meagre privileges. Foremen who pressured workers to achieve their superhuman production quotas were the most common targets, clobbered with pickaxes, pushed down mine shafts, thrown into pits of cement. Prisoners who were inclined to betray their own comrades were now too afraid to do so. Solzhenitsyn explains that in 1952, informers and collaborators lost their nerve to such an extent that the prison authorities had to lock them up in the punishment cells, which are usually obviously reserved for the political offenders themselves, and very depressing and very horrible places, for their own safety. So that was a bit of a turnaround. And as remarkable as it seems, this phenomena seems to have swept across all the camps, all over the USSR, where you had, the informers basically being knocked off and the political committees sort of asserting themselves as the authorities in the camp. Bridget Gerland, an East German communist imprisoned in Vorkuta, argued that the idea of the general strike of workers at Vorkuta was organized or was proliferated by Leninist students who were imprisoned there. According to Gerland, those students produced leaflets that read, "Fellow prisoners, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Don't expect to gain your freedom through anyone's efforts but your own. No one will help you. No one will save you. Only you yourselves can change your lot. Down tools. The strike is our only weapon." While Gerland's testimony is not corroborated by other sources, the concept of a strike of prisoners appears to have been generalised amongst the underground committees. So Solzhenitsyn's camp, which as far as we know was the first to actually have a strike during this period, he was involved in that strike at his camp at Ekibastus in Kazakhstan in January 1952. And at that camp, around 3,000 prisoners went on hunger strike for 4 days in protest at guards shooting a prisoner who was attacking an informer. So once again, he was attacking an informer, but people were so outraged that he was actually shot that they went on hunger strike. And as an example of how important political conclusions were drawn during the process of struggle, half of that camp's population were Ukrainian, and they refused to join the strike. So there was actually 6,000 prisoners in the camp, but only 3,000 participated. And that tragically proved the need to overcome national divisions. It was also thought, in the sort of retrospectively amongst prisoners, that it was really stupid, if inspiring, for the prisoners to refuse food, because it meant that they could only hold out for a short time. And the inmates from Ekibastos were transferred throughout the Gulag network in the hope that prisoner resistance would therefore be broken. But this, in this new situation, actually had the effect of generalising to a broader layer of prisoners the possibility of resistance. So in 1953, immediately prior to the strike in Vorkuta, there was also a strike at Norilsk, another location above the Arctic Circle, east of the Ural Mountains, where prisoners mined copper and nickel. During that strike, 16,000 Ukrainian workers held out for 69 days before being violently suppressed. So, and that was that sort of event was particularly inspired by the fact that a source of hope for the prisoners in the early 50s was the prospect of Stalin's death. It was widely anticipated that Stalin was going to cark it soon, and so all the underground committees were organising for this moment to be the push for liberation. In March of 1953, when Stalin died, the sense amongst prisoners and even amongst the guards was jubilation. So according to Bucha, "I'll always remember that morning. We were on our way to the mine when the announcement came over the loudspeaker that Joseph Stalin, Marshal of the Soviet Union, had died. We stopped in our tracks. Some prisoners were weeping. Everyone was moved. This was like a great earthquake. It was certain that one era in history was over, and who could know what the next would be like?" Now, while at Norilsk this led to a huge strike, the immediate effect at Vorkuta was a sense of uneasy expectancy. Many of the national minorities from Eastern Europe, like the rebels of 1947, hoped for Western intervention and saw no point in taking action themselves. This changed, though, with the news of a general strike in East Germany. So on June 6, 1953, a strike in Berlin began initially against poor conditions of work, but erupted into a movement calling for an end to the Russian occupation and the dictatorship the next day. So that's the good photo of the crowds in Berlin. Alamy stock photo, as you can see. But yeah, this is also the Soviet tanks that were brought in. This is obviously before they actually started to try and crush the revolts. Now, 500,000 workers took strike action, and 1.5 million were involved in demonstrations across the country. The Soviet military responded with brutal repression, killing 55 people and arresting thousands. Schulmer describes how the news of the crushed uprising was received in Vorkuta. So although official news of the rising in Berlin and the Eastern Zone on June 17 only appeared late and in a garbled form in the camps, it wasn't difficult to form an objective picture of what had happened. Even the ordinary prisoner felt instinctively that what had happened in Berlin and the Eastern Zone was a revolt against the police system which had arrested, sentenced, and enslaved himself. This revolt inspired the prisoners that resistance was possible, and also convinced those with illusions in the West that no outside intervention was forthcoming. Because obviously, if the West could watch millions of people go on strike and then be gunned down by Soviet tanks in East Germany, they weren't going to intervene to save prisoners in the gulags. So, unfortunately, I don't have any photos to indicate the awesomeness of this struggle, because, yes, there wasn't any photos taken. So I've just got this image that's of the actual Vorkuta camps, so as being a backdrop to this, but yeah. So at Vorkuta, following the news of the East German general strike, preparations began in earnest across the camps for a strike. There was communication between all the underground committees, apparently through friendly guards. Camp number one was assigned the lead to signal the general strike, but the authorities must have tweaked, and the leadership were arrested on July the 20th. Despite this disruption, on July 23rd, camps number 1 and number 7 had refused to go to work and remained in their barracks. Prisoners in the other camps began to notice that there wasn't any there wasn't any coal production being done in those camps. Then that led camps 6, 14, 16, and 10 to down tools. Free workers, so not actual gulag workers, building a power station outside of the camps also struck in solidarity, although we don't know what actually happened to those workers. Unfortunately, because, yeah, it's very important to what workers struggle outside of the camps. So this meant that around half of the 50,000 prison labourers at Vorkuta were on strike, crippling coal production. The initial response of the prison authorities was to make concessions. After Stalin's death and the arrest of Beria, who was the head of the NKVD, the authorities were uncertain which way the wind was blowing. Some may have feared that they would even be held accountable for their actions. Whatever the reason, camp authorities started to remove window bars and to remove the locks on cells, and as well as the numbers on the prison uniforms. This elicited a jubilant response from the prisoners, and they took upon the task themselves to break all the locks and to take off the hated numbers. And when it came to the prisoners' demands, which varied from improved conditions to freedom, the authorities of Vorkuta, according to Gerland, pleaded with grotesque politeness to the prisoners, which they had never displayed before. They promised substantial improvements in the life of the camp if work restarted. The prisoners refused and demanded an investigation of their situation by central authorities in Moscow, and a demand that was actually agreed to by the prison authorities. So while awaiting the promised delegation from Moscow, each of the striking camps was surrounded by soldiers with machine guns trained on the exits. The suddenly liberated camps produced a lively internal political life and a remarkable degree of self-organisation. At Buka's camp, a strike committee of 41 people was elected on the basis of one delegate for every barracks. The prisoners continued to maintain the coal mines, not to maintain the production, but just in order to prevent the build-up of potentially explosive gas. The strike leaders were very conscious of eschewing violence in order not to provide camp authorities any excuse to repress the strike. At Buka's camp, banners were painted that hung from the walls reading, "Coal for the Fatherland, freedom for us," and also a very mocking banner, "There is nothing more precious in the world than man himself," which is to quote Joseph Stalin. On July 31st, the commission from Moscow arrived, comprising of senior generals and government officials. The commission met with the strike leaders, including Buka, and promised improvements and a review of the prisoners' sentences. But this was clearly a ruse. During the strike, the prison authorities replaced soldiers they knew to be soft on the prisoners with more reliable troops. The very day after the meeting with the Moscow Commission, the general in charge of the camp network at Vorkuta, General Derevyanko, and a member of the Moscow Commission, Chief Prosecutor of the USSR, Roman Rudenko, appeared at the gates of Buka's camp and demanded the end of the strike. Buka describes the prisoners' response. "I went from group to group, asking for their decisions. It was the same everywhere. Death rather than surrender." The prisoners linked arms and met the generals and Rudenko at the gate. Faced with the defiance of the prisoners, Rudenko himself pulled out his handgun and fired the first shot, killing one of the strike leaders. Buka describes what happens next. "It must have been a signal. There was a salvo of shots from the guards straight into the mass of prisoners. But we were standing with our arms linked, and at first no one fell, although many were dead and wounded. Then came a second salvo, then a third, then a fourth. Then the heavy machine guns opened fire. Then the firing stopped. There was silence." Sorry. "It is difficult to know exactly how many prisoners were murdered. Buka saw hundreds of fallen prisoners. Sholmer, in a camp that had already returned to work, saw 60 corpses. Despite the news of the massacre, camp number 7 held out until being ordered by the authorities to leave or face similar fate. In order to avoid a massacre, the strike committee agreed. Once the prisoners left the compound, anyone suspected of playing a leadership role in the strike, which is about 400 people, were arrested, and the remaining prisoners, leaderless, could only abandon the strike." Sorry, I'm going to drink some water. So while the strikes at Vorkuta and elsewhere across the Gulag network were brutally crushed, and Vorkuta was not the last, there was actually an even larger uprising in Kazakhstan in a place called Kengir, which actually saw an even longer-term occupation. So it would be wrong to see in them purely a desperate but hopeless stand. In fact, the strikes heralded the end of the Gulag as a system of mass repression. Forced labour and the Stalinist dictatorship remained until the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, but the character of the regime's prisons changed, with many gulags closed in 1956 and most political prisoners released. By 1959, the population of the camps had more than halved, and of those detained, 99% were charged under non-political crimes. So basically turning into a system of mass incarceration like the United States today, but not necessarily political. The wave of uprisings and strikes from 52 to 54 frightened the regime into relaxing the perpetual search for internal enemies. Besides, Stalin's reign had extinguished any possible challenge to the bureaucratic regime he built. For his inheritors like Khrushchev, maintaining such a pervasive state terror risked creating more instability and not less. The kind of menial labour performed by camp inmates was also becoming increasingly redundant as Soviet society industrialised, which demanded more skilled and educated workers. So the strike at Vorkuta is emblematic of the importance of resistance and struggle, even during the direst of circumstances, even after stripping away basic human dignities, like their names, their privacy, not to mention any pretense of freedom, the prisoners of the Gulag would not bend. In the face of all of it, many set their sights on freedom or death, and were able to see themselves as part of not only a movement of resistance across the camps, but even against the entire Stalinist social system, as shown by the inspiration the prisoners took from the German general strike. Bucher expressed well in his memoirs of the strike what a difference it had made for the participants, and he was writing 4 days after the strike had begun. I sat outside one of the huts, out of the sight of the guards, and talked and joked to the prisoners, and thought about the changes that had taken place inside the camp during those 4 days. We had become human beings again. Anyone who saw those prisoners, from those in the hospital who had no hope of surviving, to those who were exhausted from their brutal work, could never doubt that the attempt we had made had been worthwhile, however it might turn out. I didn't know what was going to happen, but despite my fears, I was happy. See you.